Welcome to 2024 and Season 5 of the Religion Podcast, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion.
Joel, my friend, shalom, salam, hello, buena vida.
Assalamu alaikum. How you, man?
It has been far too long. Yeah, I think mostly my fault, but...
Where you been?
Well, 1 week, if I remember correctly, there was no daycare for kids. Ooh. Not for me.
Ooh.
I wish there was daycare for me. Then the next week, we were actually on a two-day vacation in Charleston, which was absolutely lovely. And then the week after that, I was at my conference with 500 Reform rabbis in Philadelphia.
Wow. So you actually you got to hang out with a bunch of brothers and sisters.
Yeah, and old friends and colleagues. And yeah, it was all of it was exhausting and wonderful and energizing and all of that. And, you know, somewhat depressing, too, as, you know, a central topic, of course, was Israel and, you know, the divisions in America and the world are also, you know, even though I think we, you know, the Reform movement is Zionist, it would be very strange to be a rabbi and kind of denounce the existence of Israel. But aside from that, the gamut of opinions is there.
Okay, before we go any deeper into this, so as not to confuse half of our listeners.
Yeah, we really might have a five-hour episode. Just our pre-talk today was, you know.
Yeah. You said...
Gather up, listeners. Get some coffee.
Get close. That's right. We got to do some term definition even to get through our intro today. You said the Reform movement is Zionist. Now, we've talked about Zionist before, but what do you mean by Zionist?
Okay, that is – I am glad you stopped me. And I have to stop – I'm going to – this really could be either a long episode or a long editing week for you. It's one of the two or both. So I need to say it because it's very much on my mind that just yesterday a congregant and friend – hosted a discussion with a Muslim colleague of hers that, you know, they've been friends and colleagues for years, that they basically had a frank and honest discussion about their feelings about the war. And it was so damn powerful. I went into it thinking it would be kind of, frankly, similar to the panel discussion I had, which was not what I wanted to do, but it's, you know, there was talk of like, we can't talk about the conflict. So it was this kind of watered down, peace is important, you know, everyone's made in God's image, which does say something important. And I think, you know, it is a step. But what these two individuals did was so powerful. I mean, people were moved to tears, they were hugging, it was incredible. So I just, now that's off my cognitive load, I can think about your actual question. So Zionism for some is a very bad word, right? Like it's equivalent to racism and colonialism. And that is, in my view, absolute garbage. For me and for many others, Zionism is the belief that Israel is and will be a safe haven for Jews. It also does not mean that it won't be a safe haven for other people, or that other people are allowed to be discriminated against because it's a safe haven for Jews. That is not what that means to me. I detest Netanyahu. I detest the settlements, and the persecution of the Palestinian people is real, I think. I'm not going to go so far as to use, you know, loaded terms like occupation, and certainly not genocide. What is happening is not genocide. It is awful. It is tragic. It is not genocide. Are you giving me a look?
Yeah.
Do we have to talk about that?
Yeah, no, we're not going to talk about that today, but I'm giving you a look. Yeah.
But Zionism at its heart means Israel has a right to exist. Now, some people say, well, why? Well, the reason is because for 4,000 years, and this is overlooked by everybody. And when I say everybody, I mean Jews included. For some reason, you know, the Jewish people forget that Israel exists as a safe place for Jews because of 4,000 years of persecution, culminating in the extermination of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust. That cannot be overstated. That's why Israel exists. That's why Zionism is, quote unquote, a thing. And that is as true in 2024 as it was, you know, when Theodor Herzl kind of started it in the late 1800s, when there was also persecution of Jews. So that's what I mean by Zionism.
We better go a smidge deeper, because Zionism, as soon as it's said, it doesn't stop at Israel has the right to have a safe national boundary space for Jews to live without oppression and persecution. In a way, I think we should take it bigger and smaller at the same time. Whatever Zion is, it is God's great community where people come from north, south, east, west, and all are safe. And there is no oppression. And it's imagined as the great city, the great polis of God. Even in the prophets and the apocalyptic literature of the Hebrew Bible, they like imagining that one day Israel will be a light to all the nations, and all the nations and all the peoples will see it as the way to do good, just, compassionate, holy community with one another. So I don't think it's enough to say that Zionism is a belief that Jews have a right to exist and be safe. I think that sells Zion short.
Okay, but to be fair, that's like, I'm still not changing my definition. In other words,
it has to start with your definition, right?
Well, no, it doesn't have to start with it. But I mean, if you're asking me what I think, that's, and the reason for that, and this is a tension, is, you know, there's this idea that there are three pillars, for lack of a better word, and Israel can only be two of them. So the three are Jewish, democratic. Oh my God. I'm forgetting the third one.
Holy?
Oh my God. No. Maybe it is just Jewish and democratic in the sense of if part of its raison d'etre, right, is being a homeland for Jewish people, then it can't be a homeland for everybody. And that is a tension. That's a real tension. It's also a small sliver of land in the midst. I mean, there are all these graphics, and of course, they all are there to prove whoever's, you know, political point is sending them. But, you know, Israel's neighbors with tens, if not hundreds of millions of Arab people, and then here's Israel with 6 million Jews. It's like, you know, really? You can't just leave us alone?
Well, that's, I think if the definition of Zion stays as you named it there, which I'm not going to pick on you about Hebrew scriptures or impose on you Greek scriptures, but I don't think that's big enough. I think in our current context, it's reasonable and it's fair and it's conventional wisdom to say, look, y'all, whatever Zion is, it needs to be at least this, and go with the definition you gave. But I don't think that that's the prophetic definition.
But look, or the scriptural when people, definition, let me put it this way. No, it's not. But let me put it this way. When people are saying that Zionism is racist and colonialist, what they're referring to is Israel's right to exist.
No.
They're not referring to this biblical idea. So in some ways, and my definition isn't reactive, like that, it's just, I mean, in some ways, it's just really simple and it's pragmatic.
It might be Zionism. I think it might be.
No, I don't think it's reactive because Zionism came about as a desire for Jews to have a homeland. That's where the word, you know, words and symbols get adopted and changed. Like that's when people first started using Zionism as a concept, that's what it was. It was a dream for Jews to move either back to Israel or for the Jews in Israel, then, you know, called Palestine, to be safe. Like that's what the term means.
Fair. Now, but let's imagine
root is
that version of Zion was appropriated by Christians around the world. And it wasn't allowed to mean what it had always meant. It got appropriated. So Christian Zionism now means we have to give the Jewish people a safe place somewhere on the planet, not so they can be safe, but so that our Messiah will come again and finally root out all evil. That's when Zionism gets yucky. And I think
100%.
Yeah.
And it's also like, it's what, at least in America, and I would even say Israel, that is not what a lot of people either believe or hope for.
If you listen to congressmen and senators when they talk
about—
Well,
that's your first mistake.
When they talk about defending Israel, they are using all the language that hollers out their agreement with those who think that not just Israel, but Jerusalem—
Joel, I'm not even saying this.
And the temple and all that.
If you're using senators and congressmen as your kind of lexicon support here, then we have a lot of other problems we need to discuss.
It's why I want to encourage you to start with Zionism from your Reformed Jewish rabbis all together who know what it means, and we're all in agreement in advance, so we can just use the word Zionism quickly. One way, when you're in that audience, use it that way. And when you're in the audience of your congregation, you have to use it a smidge different. And when you're in this audience with Christians and Jews, Zionism means something way bigger than that. It has to go that in order to get to the way bigger.
No. I absolutely understand and appreciate what you're saying. I do. I do think, though, there, regardless of term, the disconnect is that there are people that have a problem with Israel as, quote, a Jewish homeland. And if you take it out of historical context, and you're just thinking in the year 2024, when we believe in egalitarianism and gender rights, hopefully, and all these other, you know, and anti-racism and all of these things where people are equal, why the hell should one country be kind of lifted up at like America's a safe place for Jews. Other places are. By the way, America's not necessarily, but that's a different conversation. So the historical context is what I am trying. I mean, it's not my mission. Like that, I guess I just wish, I'll put it this way. I wish people that kind of, you know, put the signs and the memes of Zionism is racism, I wish they at least thought about the historical context and why Zionism is such an important reality or dream, I'm losing the right word here, but for many Jews. Not all. There are definitely some Jews that, especially after October 7th, will go out of their way to say, not all Jews are Zionist. Something I very much disagree with. I'll share on this podcast, which kind of makes it public. I don't know what I would do this is a question that came up at my conference and just in conversations. Mm-hmm. If I had a conversion candidate, for example, that was passionate about Judaism, you know, came to services, but literally denied Israel's right to exist, that would be really tough for me. I would have to do a lot of thinking and soul searching, you know, about that process. You know,
and by I think exist, we talked you about, mean a political, geographical structure.
Yes, I mean a geographical country, you know, borders to be, you know, I'm not like, this is not from the river to the sea here. And that's kind of the problem is some people take when, and I, so I actually had this happen to me. I was at this panel discussion and I talked a little bit about what you and I are talking about now, Zionism, and a few Muslim students came after me afterwards and said, well, so does Zionism mean that Israel can build settlements? And I said, absolutely not. But that's, and here is where this is my definition, but I would say many people's definition. You know, unfortunately, the actions of the government kind of speak for everyone in a sense.
Yeah. It's why South Africa sued the nation state of Israel in the UN Council because there were Israeli political and military leaders who were defining Israel's right to exist as that means we can build settlements wherever we want. That means we can go all the way from the river to the sea. That means we can remove anybody we want to remove. And
yeah, so I'll disagree with you on there, but
you can't disagree with it. They have the statements of the people saying it. So what the issue would be, you're not going to let them speak for Zionism.
But I don't think anyone said we can remove whoever we want to remove.
They're threats. They got to be moved. They're threats to our settlement in that space over the line, and they have to be removed. And we're going to put, and they said we're going to have a security border, a boundary that is thick enough so that we can't be tunneled or climbed over or be shot at across the wall. So when they built a settlement somewhere between Jerusalem and Gaza in what used to be the 67 Palestinian territories, they said they have a right to do that, and they're removing anybody that they have to and push them into Gaza because the Gaza is the last place that they're allowed to be.
And so let me pause for a second because we may be confusing some people, because like this is, you know, I've been passionate about Israel since I lived there in 1999. And Joel, you know, you have many years experience. We've both been there. Settlements is a very tough thing to wrap your head around. I would suggest there's a phenomenal book. I may have recommended it before on this podcast. It's called Can We Talk About Israel? Mm-hmm. It has at least one chapter on the settlements. It's not, you know, some people think of settlement as, oh, a place where you live. I'm going to build a settlement. It is a very specific technical term for land that Israeli citizens live on that is technically not in the boundaries of the state of Israel, but yet it's run by Israel. It's very controversial. Most American liberal Jews, I don't mean liberal like Democrat, Republican. I mean liberal like reform conservative, although of course those often interweave, are absolutely against the settlements. They're a detriment to peace. They are a talking point. You know, the Palestinians have absolutely a right to be, you know, it's similar
they're
to,
not going anywhere,
in my
though.
Mind.
Like, they're, no, they're not stopping. Anywhere. They're not backing up, right?
But let's leave it to the experts on that.
In the definition of Zionism, the settlements, that's going to be the sticky point. And that's why those kids came up to you after and asked that question. Because what does a right to exist mean? Like, what is the size? What is
right,
the boundary?
But they're also coming at it from their worldview, which, by the
of
way,
course.
I'm coming at things from my worldview.
Of course, right. And that's why we've got to be so careful with this term Zionist, right, whatever it means. Because Christians have appropriated it to mean in order for our, quote, Messiah. Now, the way some Christians talk about the Messiah coming again, it depends on a Jewish ownership of Zion. And sometimes when Christians talk about it, It only means Jerusalem and the mount on which the temple sits. So when some Christians talk about Zion, they think it's bad that the mosque is up there. And the mosque has to be wiped out and removed, and the temple has to be rebuilt on the mount. And it isn't...
Which will happen when the Messiah comes. But that's...
It will happen to allow the Messiah to come. It's a prerequisite of the Messiah coming.
Oh, I see.
Is how some Christian Zionists now say it. So the sure. fact that there's a mosque up there has to be gone. The fact that the walls are just remnants, that has to be repaired. The fact that there are churches up there that are shared between Catholic and Orthodox and Protestant organizations, those have to be removed by Jewish Israelis, and they have to rebuild their temple on the mount. And they don't think about it as a safe nation. All they think about it is the Jewish people have to control the mount that is Zion and rebuild the temple there. And that's where Christian Zionists sometimes, and some Christians who even aren't Zionists, that's where they start when they hear the word Zionist, because it's been so appropriated.
Yeah, I feel like we're having too much of a government conversation and not enough of a, kind of a religious one.
Oh, wow. How can there be any different when the, like, okay, so I had an email from a member who's like, Joel, you and Eric need to talk about, so what is Judaism? Like, I'm getting more and more confused the more I talk and listen to y'all about this. And it's interesting, and I get it. That's from a Christian worldview. Christians tend to think of religion as belief structures more than practice structures. And that's a mistake. Jesus didn't really care about beliefs as much as he cared about practices, which is why he could walk up to a Samaritan woman, why he could walk up to a Roman centurion, why Philip could go to an Ethiopian eunuch. And it was not just the beliefs, but the beliefs that became a practice. So in this space, I try to think of Judaism, and help me out here. Amos and Isaiah are the reminder to me of what we are called to be as a community. And it's justice, it's compassion, and it's righteousness. And they often, there are Hebrew words under this, so I'd love your help unpacking these words, but it's do justice, love, compassion, be compassionate, and walk rightly. We sometimes translate it humbly, but that's not it. It's, I think the word is tzedakah in that one, and there's hesed.
Tzedakah, yeah, no, that's righteousness.
And there's milbat, yeah. Right? Those big three. And the reason why we, and especially Hebrew people, Israelites, honor those three is to be a light to all peoples of how to be a healthy community with one another. So all the laws, all the Torah, all the prophetic warnings, all of that is meant to grow a beautiful community that is better than any government we've ever seen, any politics we've ever seen, any military or any democracy we've ever seen. In fact, you can erase all the governments if we would just do justice, love, compassion, and walk rightly with God, we wouldn't need governments. And I think that's how I think of the commands of God to God's people, from Exodus all the way through the prophets to today. Is that fair, or is that oversimplified?
No, I think that's fair.
Work on those three words.
It's a little cherry-picked, but that's fine. Right.
If you look at Exodus, the training, look, here's who you're going to be. And if you look at the things that got him in trouble through the Exodus, hey, here's who you're supposed to remember to be. And if you look at the warning before they go into the promised land, hey, remember, this is who you're going to be. And then if you look at the prophets' accusations when they had governments and kings, right? Even as they were choosing their first king, if you look at the prophetic warning about that, warning, you don't want a king. If you do, this will happen and then you won't be with God. So I think I don't know if it's cherry picked. It's just trying to systematize it and simplify it so that we can have a fair starting point. What is it? Tzedek, Chesed, and Milpat? Those three in a different order.
Is it Mishpat? Mishpat, I'll have to look at maybe. The Hebrew.
But those three are the big three. And the reason for those is to teach people how to do community better than our preferred way of doing community, which is capitalism or democracy or socialism or communism or autocracy or anarchy.
Say that one more time, Joel. I'm sorry. I was looking up something.
You were looking at the words again. So, yeah, exactly. Well, you can go to Micah 6, obviously, 6:8.
Yeah.
It's also Amos 5, right? And it's in Isaiah, but it's the one that Martin Luther King quoted, right? Let justice roll down like waters.
It's a famous, a very close friend of mine. That's his email signature.
Damn straight.
So, yeah. You and he would be friends. He has a lot of biblical tattoos also.
But what Micah adds is the chesed. Some people call it love. Some people call it kindness. Some people call it mercy. Some people call it compassion.
Mercy is closer. Yeah, mercy and compassion is definitely closer.
Compassion is the one I lean on because patio is suffer with. And
well, I can't argue with you if you're throwing out Latin. My goodness. No, but that's right. Yeah, that's right.
And it means that I can't just watch your suffering from over here. I can't look at you over there suffering and go, oh, that's so terrible. Oh, I'm so sorry. My call from God, if I'm going to love kindness or do compassion, is to actually suffer what you suffer with you.
Mm.
And if you suffer it, I suffer it. And I cannot imagine anyone who suffers as independent from me. What they suffer, I suffer with them.
I'm writing that down because there's a sermon there.
Yeah, there is. And see, the whole thing about Zionism, if I think of what Zion is, it is not a right to exist. It is a responsibility to craft a community of justice, compassion, and righteousness that all the other nations look to and think, dadgummit, that's so much better than the way we do it. Why don't we do it that way?
Sure.
Imagine if Netanyahu was 100% about justice, compassion, and righteousness.
Well, I mean, I'd love to, but yeah, go on.
Things would look so different in Jerusalem and in the settlements and in Gaza.
But that's true. That's true for, America and Americans. And I mean, and by the way, that's all. I mean, imagine that for Hamas and the PLA.
Yes.
And Dad, right?
Yes. And their scriptures have some of the same requirements. Is what's so beautiful. Whether you're a Palestinian Christian or a Palestinian Muslim, it's some of the exact same rules for how and why to exist.
Yeah. My lights just started flickering like very hardcore. Why is God mad at me right now? Sheesh, that was really.
Now, let me ask you a question that is attached, but may feel tangential. Is it a requirement that you were talking about this? What would you do, right, if a person was coming to you asking for conversion? Is it a requirement to believe in some type of Zionism? And if so, where do you draw the line? There's Zionism is enough.
That is exactly the question. I mean, so, you were talking about Judaism not being a belief system. What I would say is a slight change, but I think it's an important change. It's not only a belief system. In other words, it would be hard to consider oneself Jewish without some sort of respect of the Torah. By the way, the word not following, like you don't have to follow all the mitzvot. Now, of course, someone could be born halakhically, meaning by Jewish law Jewish, and could say, yes, I'm Jewish, and not, you know, never even have heard of the Torah, ostensibly. Yeah, technically they're still Jewish, but what does that really mean, right? So, like, would I accept them as Jewish in my congregation? Sure, but, you know, it like, what is their identity based on? Like, that's the more meaningful question. So, but I think Israel is so much a part of our prayers, of our, it's just extant in everything in terms of Judaism. And yes, a lot of that is Am Yisrael, the people Israel, which, you know, the Hebrew words Am Yisrael existed way before 1948, right? But the land and the country is a huge part of, I think, Jewish identity. So for me, as the rabbi converting someone, I think yes. Now another rabbi can come to a different choice. But I think certainly in, you know, with regard to the rabbis I know, which is not only limited to Reform rabbis, if someone's identity was very explicitly not, you know, kind of anti-Zionist, not anti, you know, because anti-Israel is another loaded term. Like, what does that mean, right? Uh-huh. But literally, like, I do not think Israel should exist. Yeah, I think that's a problem. I also think it's a problem for Jews who are born Jews to think that. Like, does Israel have a lot of things? Yeah. Yes. Like, you know, does Israel have a hell of a lot of problems that it needs to figure out? Does it have a racism problem and a, you know, a fear of the stranger problem? And yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Does the government do awful things to Palestinians? Yes. Mm-hmm. Do Palestinians have a rightful claim on the land? Yes. Mm-hmm. A lot of Jews are going to be upset with me on that one. By the way, does that mean they should all move back to their homes pre-1948? Well, that is the problem, because that's impossible. Yeah. If they move back to their land, Israel stops being a safe state for Jews. If they don't move back to the land, then they have a rightful kind of claim. That is a real problem.
Yeah.
But to deny Israel's right to exist, yeah, I have a problem with that, a real problem with that.
Okay. And so, all right. I think I don't know if I'm seeing something or not, but I'm going to try. So my, Hebrew Bible, a professor at Columbia Theological Seminary in Atlanta, Decatur, Georgia, was Walter Brueggemann. And
oh, sure. You've mentioned him before.
Yeah. He was trying to teach us Christians how to read the Hebrew Bible, because he knows that we go into this thing we call the Old Testament with some really clouded eyeballs, and we don't read it well. We read it through Jesus, the Christian. And Jesus was a Christian. We read it as if it was all preparing us for Jesus. And he wanted us to think of it as, no, do not think of it that way. It was something different. And the thing that he emphasized really early, really strongly, and made sure we never forget, is that these are people of the land. Everything about the Hebrew Bible has something to do with land. Their loss of it, their regaining of it, their hope for moving toward it, their being in it and trying to protect it, their losing it to invaders, their losing it because of their own mismanagement, they're losing it to war, or they're losing it because they mistreated the poor and the immigrant and the orphans incorrectly. He goes, it's not just treat orphans well because you're supposed to, or treat the elderly well because you're supposed to, or welcome the immigrant because you were once an immigrant. It's do all these things because the land depends on it. Your access and right to being in the land itself, or to even having land at all, is dependent on you learning the lessons of being a slave, being on the run, being a stranger, a nomad, and then one day you're given land. Now, do it better than Egypt did. Do it better than all your oppressors did. And I'm just now figuring out, as we've been talking today, that when you say Israel has a right to exist, you mean a land. Israel has a right to a land somewhere. And I'm
okay. No, not somewhere. The land of Israel. I mean, I want to be fair. I mean, the
Jerusalem land. Plus minus, yes.
And by the way, that's in some ways, that's not. Yes, Jerusalem is a holy place, by the way, for Muslims and Christians also. That's not even the reason. The reason is because that's where they are now. Like, you can't go back in history. Like, it would be like saying, well, America, America stole the land from indigenous people. So to make things right, we're going to give it back to them and we're going to go somewhere else. Like, that's not possible. That doesn't mean it's not heartbreaking, but it's just not possible.
Yeah.
Like, in a pragmatic way,
yeah.
Right? I don't mean in a righteous indignation way.
Okay. But in that land that you're now not giving back, nor is America giving it back, the responsibility that comes with sitting on that land, which is not yours, it's God's, is to be a light to the nations. To grow a community of justice, compassion, and righteousness. And the definitions of that is the Jewish purpose, in a way, and the Christian purpose, I think, which is why I don't see much, like, I don't ever have to fight with you about why we exist, right? Because if we're doing it well, we're creating a community that can do this, that can be just and fair and compassionate, and not just fair, just and compassionate and righteous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing too, and I think I may have said this on the podcast, and I'm definitely using it in a sermon, is what we forget, not just people, I forget it too, is, there is a big difference between ideals and practice. And so, in other words, it is resources are limited.
Yeah.
So, in other words, like, it's easier to share a house when you have 8,000 square feet and like, let's say a family, just like Katrina, right? Like, people let in families after Hurricane Katrina. You have a huge house, that's easy to do. Let's say you have a one-bedroom apartment and you have to do it. You're probably going to fight with those people a lot more. You might even fight with them so much that you kick them out.
Yeah.
Whereas if you lived in a mansion with multiple bathrooms and kitchens and all those things, it would be a lot easier. Well, that's what Israel's like. I mean, the part I'm going to use in a sermon is, Abraham and Lot, they both – and this is family now. I mean, they're kin, although Israelis and Palestinians are kin also.
Nice.
The passage, Abraham and Lot, they each became wealthy and had many, many things and many servants, and they started infighting. And so what happens? Abraham says, if you go north, I'll go south. If you go west, I'll go east. And they part amicably. Well, but what happens when there's no more room to the north or south or west and east, and we have to live together?
Mm-hmm.
That's the situation. And I think far too often we get caught up in these, in kind of the theological values and not the practicalities. Because the values are easy. It's how do you live those values that are really damn hard.
I read something last night with our pub theology small group, and it's sticking with me. And I think it's right on what you're saying. The authors of the book we're using redefined faith for me in a way that I hadn't really thought about it. They said, faith is not belief. Belief is a precursor to faith. But beliefs, or let's say values, what I think or feel that I stand for, or what I say is important to me, and what I lift up as a higher priority or more true, those are beliefs. They become faith when you risk your life for them. When you trust those values so much that you actually live your values and your beliefs and your core principles. And faith is the embodiment of the belief. No matter how naive or impractical it is, you live it. And I thought, oh no, that explains a lot why we can have certain beliefs as in religious communities or other communities, political party communities, but we don't actually practice them because we don't believe our beliefs so much that we're willing to trust them to become
actions. Well, I just think, so I appreciate that explanation. I think it's more that, and this is true for me. I mean, that it's easy to have a value when you don't have to do anything in conflict with that value. Right?
That's it.
So, you know, it's easy to be honest when you don't find it's easy to be ethical and say, oh yeah, you know, we should return things that are found. Well, let's say that you can't afford, you know, your rent, and you come across and you find $100 bill on the ground. Like, that's now the value. Now let's see how strong that value is, right?
Mm-hmm. And justice isn't fair in that moment, which means that the belief or the value.
That's right. Well, that's a whole different. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. If an unemployed welfare mom of three who's on cancer treatment parks in the handicap spot for a second at CVS and gets a $500 fine, right? That's different than the hedge fund manager in his, you know, high, top of the line Tesla, who zips in there just so he can go grab a soda and gets a $500 fine. Like, it's not just.
It is, but I don't know how, but again, so moving to the practicality, like, how do you legalize for that? I mean, I totally agree with you, of course.
In the Hebrew Bible, the judges didn't have as many strict laws about those kind of things. They had the ability to judge for justice, and they took into account the context of the person that was in front of them. And I don't know how we would. We're not used to that. We codify everything equally, which means it's not just.
Right. But there is also a difference. And I completely agree with you. I'll say this until my dying day, God willing, in a very long time, that justice is not the same as law. Law is about order. Law is not about justice.
Ooh, thank you.
Now, some laws are just. I'm not saying laws aren't just, but the goal of law.
It's the training wheels towards justice.
Yeah. I mean, it's for order. It's how do we live in a society together? I mean, you can't have justice without values. Law is not about values.
Right. But if we were just and compassionate and righteous with and to one another, we wouldn't need laws. Laws
Correct.
Are the training wheels to try to teach us.
I like that, the training wheels. And look, we do need laws. I would go, look, I mean, you know, we just got back 2 weeks ago from Charleston for 2 days, right? It's a 4-hour drive. We got two toddlers in the back seat. I would drive fast if it wasn't illegal. I would.
Get these kids out of this car faster.
Like, not, I'm not going 100 miles fast because that's, because now that's a value of mine that's unsafe.
You're
for me, that
kids.
Would be unsafe. Yeah. Uh-huh. But would I go 85 with my adaptive cruise control? Sure. But the fear of being pulled over and getting a ticket and then, of course, getting yelled at by my wife, like, I don't want that. So it's the law. It's the fear of consequence.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and maybe that's – so I'm – in all of this, one of the reasons I think we do this podcast is to help people who are of either the Christian faith / religion or the Jewish identity, faith, religion, and those who are of neither, right, have some sense –
for sure.
Right, have some sense of the difference between the way Christians either co-opt Judaism or – attack it, right? And we know there are Christians that do both. Or the way some Jewish practices exclude Christians from being brothers and sisters. We're less than in some kind of way. Or so how do you and I embody, actually put into practice faithfully the beliefs structures that we have individually? And as congregational leaders. And I hope that people here today, like if we think of Zion as a law, right, then it's a training wheels on the path to something bigger and better. If we think of the religious laws that either Judaism or Christianity try to abide by, well, they're training wheels to get us to something bigger. And it is a universal community that is justice and compassion and righteousness sewn into it, where those are the only choices we make, those are the only decisions we make, those are the only actions and words we take and speak.
Well, this is something a colleague said we had these small group discussions that, quite frankly, I was rolling my eyes, like, you know, with like the group rules of someone talks and you don't interrupt and then you ask proper follow-up questions. And like, you know, it's 500 rabbis. And so we definitely need the rules. But I was also like, it turned out it was one of my favorite things at the conference. And one of the people I was sitting next to that I got randomly paired with, who's been a friend of mine for over 20 years, said something, and he's more to the right of me on Israel. And I mean, he would say the same thing. He said, look, I'm not neutral. Israel's my family. I care more about my family than other people. That doesn't mean, you know, I'm heartless or I don't care about the tragedy, you know, in for the Palestinian people. But ultimately, like, I have to worry about my family. And like, I get what he's saying. And there is, you know, there is a bias, and it's something that I think all of us don't admit to ourselves. Like, you know, very few people when arguing for or against Israel say, well, you know, I grew up a Muslim or I grew up a Jew, therefore Palestine is important to me, therefore Israel is important to me. It's just kind of implicit in what we say, but we really need to recognize that.
Yeah.
And so in response to what you said, like, yes, there is a, I think, embedded within Judaism, Islam, Christianity, there is very much a universal call for justice. And there's also kind of, I don't know if it's human nature or what we would attribute it to, but like at the end of the day, we are going to be more caring of our quote unquote family, however you define family. You're shaking your head.
It's a danger the tendency or the cultural training is that our family is more important than our congregation, which is more important than our political party, which is more important than our country, right? Which is more important than our neighbors on the other side of the world who are of different religions and different countries. But I think there's something core to the Jewish identity that I find in Hebrew scriptures and that I adopt onto myself as a Christian is that, look, when that alien or that immigrant comes in among you, they are not part of your family. They have different religious traditions. They have different skin color. They have different habits and a different language, whatever. But when they come in to your holy, just, righteous, compassionate community, you will treat them as if they are family. You will adopt them as if they are family. They will not be second-class citizens to you. You will love them as you wish to be loved yourself. And that is a Pollyanna, Zionistic goal that sounds naive and silly, whatever. But if a rabbi says to me, hey, look, I'm biased for my own people against foreigners, I just want to read them a little bit of Deuteronomy.
No, I wouldn't say against foreigners. I would put it, so I'm reading this book right now that I'm recommending to everyone. It is not an easy read, but it is brilliant. It is called, I'm getting the title right now, and I have like 20 pages left. It's called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided. Joel, you have to read this book, by the way.
The Righteous Mind.
This is so
mind.
Up your alley.
I have that one.
Why good people are divided by politics and religion. It's written by Professor Jonathan Haidt, listeners, this is for you too, Haidt, Jonathan. Oh, Joel's pulling it out right now.
We studied it at OPC. We studied it at OPC. I had a whole small group on it. I've already got highlights and underlines and everything.
Oh, fantastic. So he's a social psychologist specializing in moral psychology. The book is very research-based. It's not like an op-ed from the New York Times. Not that those aren't well-written and have their place, absolutely. Lots of psychology experiments are quoted and things like that. So if you're into, you know, that kind of more intellectual sounds highfalutin, but you know, that's what it is. But anyway, he talks about, now I want to see if I can remember what I read. This is good for me. So, Durkheim was a social psychologist that proposed that, you know, just like there's self-selection for individuals natural selection, there's natural selection for groups. And so, without getting into the specifics that I'm going to get wrong anyway, in the book, Haidt talks about there have been experiments that show that, first of all, group cohesion, of course, is a thing, mm-hmm. right? Like we put ourselves in groups, whether it's religion, hobby, age, gender, you know, whatever, politics. But when people feel strongly about their group connections, yes, they prioritize those group connections, but they don't, for me, this was counterintuitive. They actually don't demonize those not in the group. So it's not about, I'm in this group, therefore I care about you less. It really is the reverse, which, yeah, you could say it's, you know, a distinction without a difference, but I think it is different. Me being Jewish doesn't make me hate others more. It makes me love Jews more. And yeah, there's a similarity there, but it is not the same.
I don't know if that's what the commandment is like to treat
no,
the immigrant
not.
Or alien or foreigner as a little bit different. There are, 100%. Weirdly enough, in Leviticus, there's a ton of rules that basically say, look, you will treat the stranger, resident, alien among you as one of you. And then there are other commands that say, but make sure that, you know, if that the resident alien does not get access to this, or they can have the leftovers, or they are welcome to be among you, but they should not be the person that you marry your daughter to. So there are distinctions in the quote law part of the Torah on how to love your family more without hating or abusing the resident alien, stranger, immigrant among you. But what is weird is the Torah, the law, the training wheels towards just society then help us justify why we differentiate. And we assume that that justification is biblical. But I don't think the justification is biblical. I think it's practical. And I get it. Like, let's say I had somebody come into my Christian congregation and explode it with their stuff, right? With the way they talk, the way they treat.
Like toxic behavior. You said explode.
Yucky, right? And they are mean and they are hateful and they are arrogant and they are accusatory and they are just destroying
Nobody acts like that. Nobody acts like that in religious institutions. That's ridiculous.
I would have to work with leaders and we would have to put boundaries on them, which means I am treating them differently, right? Not because of who they are or what they believe or where they're from, but because they are no longer shining the light of justice and compassion and righteousness to all the peoples. And part of who we agree to be here, regardless of our faith, belief, identity, religion, is to be a light shining people of justice, compassion, and righteousness. And if you enter into us and you suck at doing that, we get it. We're going to help you do that. And we're not going to give you access to the lighthouse where you can bash out the bulbs. Like, no, you can't climb the tower and bash out the lighthouse bulbs. We need them to shine a light of justice and compassion and kindness to the nations. So to earn your way up the staircase to run the lighthouse, yeah, there's a path to that. But how do you treat someone as in when they suck at being in? That is the challenge. It's the same question you had as, do I convert somebody who is kind of half-hearted about Israel?
Oh, not half-hearted. I don't know that I have a problem with half-heartedness.
A third-hearted or a fifth-hearted. All right, we did a lot today. That's almost an hour. I'm going to have to edit this down to 45 minutes.
Somehow. And by the way, didn't even get to our topic.
Yes. Well, you started talking about Zion. That is our topic. And I don't know if you noticed.
You got all excited.
But I wove it in over and over.
We got to a topic.
That's right.
No, but this is necessary. And look, the truth is the war, this is not going to be the last time we talk about this either. And, you and I are both aware that, you and I have some differences of opinion too, which, by the way, is totally fine. My quote unquote big thing that is, I just wish, as I've said to people locally, the situation in the Middle East is possibly the most complicated geopolitical issue of our time, save maybe climate change. Mm. And so for people to say free Palestine from the river to the sea, or I stand with Israel, as statements that stand on their own without background, without nuance, without understanding of where millions of people on the other side, whatever that other side is, that is not bringing peace. That's only further alienating and dividing. And we have to, at the very least, be open. So I'll end with how I began this conversation that I went to yesterday. The title of it included the word humility. I don't have the flyer in front of me, but it was like, a talk based on understanding. And, like I said, humility was in there. And I just love that idea that all of us are in our bubbles, whatever that bubble is. It could be political. It could be gender. It could be gender identity. It could be, it doesn't matter, but we're all in them. And so when you have a view, that view is shaped by that community. Mm-hmm. You have to understand views of other communities. Mm-hmm. You have to. And so I wish, I mean, the people that I interact with are mostly Jews. So my wish is for more Jews to do that. Yes, I wish more, mm-hmm. more Muslims and Palestinians did that too. But, you know, I don't, that's not the area that I have, you know, any sort of, not, I won't say any, that's not where I have my pulpit. So I'll preach it to Jews and some will get mm-hmm. mad at me for it. And, you know, hopefully more won't.
Okay, Hebrew scholar, humility, and then Micah 6, walk humbly. I think the word under humbly in Micah 6 is tzedakah.
Tzedakah.
The rightly, the righteousness, right? So.
Yep, righteousness or justice, yep.
So how interesting, right? The least humble people are often the most self-righteous people, or who the people who think they are protecting righteousness, right, the most honorably. But we may have to come back to that. I want to put on our future podcast episodes, how does humility, humbly, be a synonym to righteousness/justice? And also on our future episode list is the Tikkun Olam, the call to social justice, whatever that means. How does that play in the Jewish belief structure and world? And what does that look like in the Jesus-y, Christian-y side of things? And then also on our future podcast episode is Jewish belief system versus practice. Like, and we may need to do that one first in order to really understand the beliefs that inspire the practices of justice and righteousness and humility.
Yeah. No, those are good topics and ways to kind of distill them. I like that.
Next week's Holy Week for us, but we'll record. The following week, I'm away on vacation. So we won't record on April 3rd. And then we'll come back to you on April 10th. So look for this episode and then one at the end of the Holy Week for us between Maundy Thursday and Easter, and then nothing the following week, and then something April 10th. I bet you've got a holiday coming up.
Well, Shabbat's every Friday, but also a Purim is this weekend, which that could be a whole episode too. It's a super fun holiday, but also with a lot of depth in it. But it is definitely fun. There's a lot of merriment.
Nice.
Well, Joel, I'll talk to you soon. And for everyone else, you know, prayers for peace and righteousness for us and the world. And, you know, and most definitely, let's make that real, pun intended.
Thank you for joining us on the Real Religion Podcast today, where a rabbi and a reverend walk into a podcast and talk real about religion. I'm Reverend Joel Talbert, and on behalf of Rabbi Eric Linder and all the Real Religion fans out there, we thank you for being with us today and invite you to send us any feedback or suggestions or topic ideas to realreligionpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep it real.